Thank you for downloading the podcast of the Virginia Biotechnology Association. This edition of the podcast features Dr. Charles E. Hamner, DVM and PhD, who retired March 31, 2002 after leading the North Carolina Biotechnology Center for 14 years. When Dr. Hamner joined the center in February of 1988, the state had a fledgling biotechnology industry. Today, North Carolina is among the nation's top five biotechnology states with several hundred thriving bioscience contract research, device, and other supporting companies throughout the state. Under his leadership, the center strengthened the state's biotechnology industry by investing more than $50 million in the state's universities, seed funding 62 startup companies, and creating a $26 million venture capital fund for new companies. Dr. Hamner's presentation, Key Factors of Attracting the Biotechnology Industry to a State, was presented on December 14th at the Virginia Biotechnology Association's Conference on Economic Development Strategies for the Bioscience Industry. The event was held at the Virginia Biotechnology Research Park in Richmond. Dr. Hamner is introduced by the president and CEO of the Biotech Park, Robert T. Skunda. The program lasts approximately 1 hour.
To introduce our featured speaker, Dr. Charles E. Hamner, who has Virginia roots, although he's really been recognized for his efforts in leading North Carolina to an exalted position in terms of what that state has accomplished in the biotechnology industry. Dr. Hamner joined the North Carolina Biotechnology Center after 10 years as the Chief Operating Officer of the UVA Medical Center and 5 years as Director of Program Coordination at A.H. Robbins Company here in Richmond. So as I say, he has Virginia roots. Just recently, Dr. Hamner was recognized by the North Carolina Business Magazine as one of the most 25 influential business leaders in that state's history. So, again, what he has done for North Carolina has been recognized by his peers and by their leaders. So I hope you'll join me in recognizing and welcoming Dr. Charles Hamner.
Bob, thank you very much. I want to say how pleased I am to have you all invite me to attend this conference today, because the whole time I was at the University of Virginia, I used to try to encourage the state to have these kinds of conferences. And so I'm delighted to be here. It's always fun to come back to Richmond, you know, having been here at A.H. Robbins and then coming down with the university to the legislature so often over about a 10-12 year period, at always enjoyed coming to Richmond. As Bob told you, I've been retired about 4 years now, and I don't give very many talks anymore, but Mark Herzog called me and said he'd like for me to tell what we did in North Carolina, and then maybe you all could use some of those things here in Virginia to improve your life science industry and also to increase your economic development efforts. So I'm delighted to be here. I want to thank O'Brien Adkins, the architects and engineering firm there in Research Triangle Park, for doing my slideshow for me. not having the things I need to do that now, they're very kind to do that for me. Mark wanted me to talk about three things. He said he wanted me to tell you all how we went about trying to convince a conservative political leadership in North Carolina to support a new and advancing technology. And he wanted to know what programs we developed to deal with the emerging technologies, and we're going to talk about all of that, and then comment on how the public's funds were spent, especially in venture capital initiatives that are all across the state of North Carolina now, how it works and what the impact was. So I'm going to start off by simply talking about how we convinced the conservative leadership, and then we will get into the other things. And Nicole, you can turn this thing on anytime you want to. I'm going to be talking about how we convince people. When I went to North Carolina in 1988, the Biotechnology Center had no budget. And the new governor, Jim Martin, has said that he didn't know, thank you very much, said that he didn't know for sure. Can you all hear me okay?
Great.
Yeah, okay. I'll stand close to this. The new governor, Jim Martin, said, well, I'm not sure this biotechnology stuff is really what we want to do. And the president of the university system said, all that bunch is going to do is compete with the universities and get all of that research money away. So that was the environment we went in. Fortunately for me, the chairman of the board of the Biotechnology Center was a state senator from Durham, North Carolina. His name was Jerry Hancock. And Jerry said, well, Charles, we want you to put together a business plan. We want you to talk that around the state. We want you to build a headquarters building. Now, what can we do for you as a board? And I said, Jerry, I want to meet the 30 most influential people in North Carolina. And if you'll take me around and introduce me to those 30 people, I'll explain to them what I think I'm going to do. Hopefully some of them will decide to help, and if they do, we'll use them plus the business plan and we'll sell it. And he did. He took me around to meet all these people. I would say half of them said, boy, that's a pretty good idea and I'm going to help you. Just let me know how I can help you. About half of them, the other half, except for two or three, were saying, well, it'll be interesting to see what you do with that. And then two or three of them said, you know, I don't think this is a good idea. We're not going to waste state's money. So in those instances, I always ask them, what was their objective? I mean, what was their objections? And they said what that was. And then I tried to get them to neutral. As long as they weren't against me, I didn't worry about it. So once we completed that job, I met with the governor, and I said, Governor Martin, you and I have one thing in common. We're both PhDs in chemistry, so we ought to be able to talk about something. And so then we talked about chemistry as involved in heterocyclic compounds relating to biochemistry and biotechnology. And so when we finished the meeting, he said, well, I'm going to put $6 million in a budget for you. I said, thank you. That's exactly what I need. Then we went and talked to the Speaker of the House and the Senate Pro Temp people who were just really good old boys. And they said, well, boy, we don't know whether you know what you're talking about or not, but you talk like us. And so I said, well, that's good enough for me. And so the Lieutenant Governor put the bill in for me, and the head of the NER Appropriations Committee, Carrie, he ran the bill through, and we got started. And then every 2 years from that time on, I made a tour of the state, and I would go to the homes of all of the legislators that got elected, new, and re-educated. And then I went to every home of every Appropriations Committee member, and I re-educated them. About the 10th time, they were sorry to see me coming, but they knew what I was going to say. Anyway, I was able to get them to understand some of it and believe in most of it. And the way I did that was, they were all out in the rural areas, and so they raised soybeans and cotton and strawberries and blueberries and pigs and chickens and things. So when we went there, we didn't go and say, well, I want you to give me $10 million. In fact, I never brought that up. We would talk about how biotechnology could improve the blueberries to make them bigger, the chickens to grow faster, the pigs to be leaner, and so forth. And then I said, thank you all for listening. I hope you'll help me when we come to the legislature. And that was the total extent of how we got the people to help us. So now, if I can get these slides. I want to start with the fundamentals of technology development. Now, that would be sort of an insult to most of you because you all know more about this than I do, probably. But I want you to think about it in a holistic way and in a comprehensive way. I go talk to states all over the place. I guess I've given this lecture to 14 states. The people in North Carolina always complain when I go. And I said, you have nothing to worry about. They pay no attention to me. And the reason for that is that they pick and choose rather than do comprehensive. And I'm sorry there are no shortcuts to this thing, but it's 10 years of hard work and you've got to have all the infrastructure in place. If I could give you that one message, then we could go from there. So let's talk about some of the fundamentals and see what happens. Now, let's see. Okay, I've got the right button. Fundamentals of it. The process and technology is complicated. I think there are two things that I can show you that visualize how the whole thing takes place. The technology is a continuum, and it moves from idea to product. It's complicated, it's long-term, it's sequential, and it has to be very deliberate. Now, these are kind of the generic stages. You start with the discovery. You do some proof of concept, you do some applied research, you finally get a prototype that you think you can sell to somebody, you figure out what the market might be for that kind of approach. If there are regulatory matters, and in the biopharmaceutical world, that's a real hurdle. And then hopefully someday somebody will let you manufacture and market these things. Those are the major stages. Now, this thing doesn't happen linearly. And when you approach a new technology, it takes a long time to develop that technology from the idea of the technology to the mass utilization of it. It goes through three stages, and it depends on what the technology is as to how long each of those stages lasts. But if it's electronics, it's much shorter than it is if it's biopharmaceuticals and life sciences. But you have an innovation and development stage, you have an exponential growth phase, and this is something people really miss. They don't understand that this thing is going to be exponential once it takes off. And it'll grow as rapidly as 20% a year compounded when it gets going. Now, the good news is for the life science industry, it's not too late to get in. The life science industry is about 20% to 25% up that green curve right now. And it's not any more than that. It might even be 15% before it's all over. But you're early in the growth phase of biotechnology and biopharmaceutics. And then, normally you can say if you took an average, you get about 25 years in the development stage, about 25 or 30 years in the growth phase, and then you have about 25 to 30 years worth of topping out. And that's going to be longer than that probably in the biotechnology, biopharmaceutical world, because as we get into genomics and bioinformatics and biomarkers and all these things of individualized therapy and so forth, I think the growth phase is going to expand out to be longer than normal. And then there are hundreds of agricultural, industrial kinds of biotechnology that have to do with enzyme development and so forth. So this is a real winner, and you can get into the game. Or you already entered the game, but you don't have to hesitate to push to move this game forward. Okay. Now, it's essential. One thing Mark asked me about, how do you prepare for an emerging technology? And the key here is that each stage represents specific things that you have to put in place. And you should be thinking about putting in place today, wherever you are on the curve, you need to be thinking about putting in place today the programs you're going to need 5 years from now. Because the time you get them in place and get them up and running so that they're really effective and can move you up the growth curve, It's going to take you 3 to 5 years. So you have to think that far ahead. So in the innovation stage, you need strong science, good research funding, university technology-based, a university-based technology transfer program. We'll talk about all these things as we go along. In the growth stage, you've got to have technology conversion and R&D. You have to have workforce development. The requirement for workforce develops much faster than you realize. A pool of managers, a comprehensive long-term financing program. And at the maturity stage, then alliances and partnerships become very important. You need all kinds of information databases. We live in the information world today. You have to have good information sources, leading edge. Where are we going now so you can get ready for 5 years from now? And then constant technology upgrades. Now, one thing that people sort of glance over, and I put it up at the front of the talk because people glance over the issues. Issues are intrinsic to any new technology. Some of them you can expect, but some of them are totally new, that you're off the wall, you never thought it was going to happen. They vary from stage to stage and by participants' point of view, and we'll talk more about that. It depends on how you look at all this, what an issue is, and how important that issue is. The process involves a lot of different participants, components, and institutions and groups all tied up in these issues. The issues can be societal or political, ethical or personal, or in most cases, it's an overlapping mixture of all of these things. And so it's no easy little bundle to handle to make all of that come out so everybody moves in the same direction. The societal issues and ethical issues are particularly sensitive in the biotechnology world because you're doing what the good Lord has done in the past, and you have to be very careful about what you're doing. And that's why things like stem cells are so sensitive, and that's why things about people's personal medical records and their genetic profiles are so sensitive. Not to mention all the genetically modified organisms. Okay. Lots of things go on simultaneously. The further up the curve you go, the more complex it gets because so many different people are doing so many different things all at the same time. And that's where the financing becomes critical. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. Now, looking at it from 30,000 square feet, there are three things you need to do. The first and most important thing is to build up the intellectual capital. The more smart and innovative people you have in Virginia, the better off you are. And you want them to be the best in the world in their business. You've got to develop a comprehensive financial resources, and you've got to train your human resources. Now, you can have 1,000 programs probably to satisfy those three things, but if you satisfy those three macro needs, you will have something that really works. Now, you need a complete infrastructure. Now, a complete infrastructure includes at least the scientific expertise, strong research universities, facilities, labor resources, comprehensive finance, support and service elements, and government and policy, governmental policy structure that is business friendly and progressive. Now, what we're going to do for the rest of the talk now is sort of walk through what we did in North Carolina for those issues right there. Now, I broke them out into 6 different programs. Programs to finance things because it all begins and ends with whether you have any money. Research and development, leadership and partnership. There's no substitute for somebody being a champion and having a logical plan to go forward and people believe in that person, plus having partnerships with everybody. All the stakeholders have to be involved. You need to understand your regional capabilities, and I'll talk about regional capabilities a little later. You need to do workforce training, and you need to handle the societal issues. If you're going to get into a political fight every morning about whether you're doing stem cells or not, you're going to have trouble getting things done throughout your state. The first thing we did in North Carolina was to build up a research universities. Now, I'm going to tell you the programs that we did. That doesn't mean they're exactly the ones you need to use. It's not in any way to be referred. It's just what we did and what the outcome was. And my return on investment is not going to be like the bankers looking for 8%, because if it was 8%, I'm not interested in it in the first place. What we are looking for is how many state dollars we put into something as an investment and how many dollars came into the state. And then when these dollars come into the state, they are recycled through all parts of the economy, so they get multiplied in the effect. So even when I say the return on investment is $1 billion for North Carolina, it probably means $3 billion worth of good, because it's recycled through all the different parts of the economy. So first thing we did was build up the University of Life Sciences. Now, we knew that the university gets federal and state monies, or some state monies at least, for basic research, most 90% of it, maybe 95% from federal government. And then to do their applied research and their development, they get help from industry and to some extent from angel investors. We'll talk about that a little bit, but that's kind of a new thing for the university, the angel investment part. Now, the reason it's so important to have strong university research is to invent things. And then once these things are invented, it is absolutely essential to develop the technology where the technology is invented. And the reason for that is the very first thing. Jobs are created where the technology is developed. If you create something in Charlottesville and sell it to somebody in Chicago, or license it to somebody in Chicago, the jobs are developed in Chicago. It's long gone from the university or from Virginia. And so it is really important to develop your technologies at home, because that's what... And in the end, the real payoff in technology development is at the end of the process, where you create manufacturing jobs. You create 3 manufacturing jobs at the end for every job created in the rest of the entire cycle. So if you really want to have good paying jobs for the middle income people of the world and create a lot of jobs, you've got to do it at the manufacturing level. So you want to invent your technologies, create them at home, and build manufacturing plants. Then you're going to make a lot of money, and your state's going to be very well off. Okay. Another reason for doing all this at home is inventor's expertise is important. It leverages the value of the IP. It extends a research university's role in public service, and that's really an important thing. First off, since universities are more interested in teaching and research, it opens up new teaching opportunities by creating these things at home. Then it creates local jobs. And then last but not least, it increases income to the university research program. They can plow the money back into the university. Now, inside the university, in order to make that work, you've got to have strong science faculty and something like an eminent scholars program. You bring these young, bright, innovative people in, you set them up so they can do the inventions and conversion of the technology. Multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary activities. Technology conversion is really important. Today, 90% of the universities do licensing of IP. Some of them are beginning to do some good translational research, and some of them are starting up young companies. The University of Virginia has something called Spinner Technology that's starting up young companies and helping with translational research. I'm sure Virginia Tech does some of that, and you may be doing it here at VCU. It's the right way to go. It leverages the value of your investment tenfold by doing that. It's very important. Okay, now, to show you what kind of money and stuff we're talking about, these are 2-year-old data now, and I'm sure Bob McWright's going to have more recent data, but it's over $1 billion now just for licensing fees. So that's a lot. From that data, it looks like about one out of every four invention disclosure can turn into some type of a licensing arrangement. They, back in 2004, they started 425 companies. That's a lot more than they did, say, in the year 2000. And I expect this year it's probably 500 or 600. I don't know how many it is, but it's probably 500 or 600. The interesting thing about it is 10 or 12 institutions count for over half of that. And so it's easy to find out who they are and go talk to them and find out, you know, what are you guys doing and how can we do it the way you do it? Okay. Return on technology development. Majority, the great majority, I'd say 90% of the universities spend about 1% of their research expenditures on technology conversion and transfer. And they receive back about 2% of their things. This really ought to be 6 or 7%. And if they would do better jobs of translational research and start up with small companies, you could easily get the 6 or 8% return and spend probably about 2.5% to 3% of your research expenditures on that effort to do. So it's a huge return on investment for the universities to do the translational and the startup company sort of things. Leading ones are all over the country. I just listed some that are all over the country. They're in California and Georgia, University of Wisconsin and Michigan in the middle of the country. Wake Forest University does a great job right there in North Carolina. Now, that's not to say that NC State doesn't have a good program. They do have a good program. But Wake Forest has figured out how to really leverage their stuff, and they do probably 7 times more than North Carolina State in return on their investment, which is really interesting. And then, of course, up in New York and New England area, you have a Columbia and New York University. As an example, Bob McWright can give you even more examples from Florida and other places. The first thing we did was to help recruit outstanding research faculty. Now, when I was at the University of Virginia one day, Frank Herford called Ray Hunt and I in and said, we want to make the University of Virginia the number one liberal arts university, public university in the country. That was 1978. And he said, I'm going to go out and raise the money, and I want you all to set programs up that will move our university to number one. And so Ray, of course, was the executive vice president and finance officer, and I was working at the medical center. And we set up something called Executive Planning Group, and we asked all the deans and vice presidents and things, give us 4 or 5 great ideas that we can implement with Frank Kerfer's money, and then we'll do those and see if we can move the university here to be number one. And one of the 4 or 5 things that we decided to do, which I'm not going to get into here, but one of them was Eminent Scholars Program. And for between 78 and 88, I think the University of Virginia hired about 350 of the world's best people in whatever it was they did. And I think it was 1986 or 87 that when the U.S. News and World Report came out, the University of Virginia was the number one liberal arts public university in the country. So if you think big and put the right infrastructure in place, it can be done. So when I went down to North Carolina, the first thing I did was to set up an Eminent Scholars Program, and the Biotech Center would put $500,000 up, and we would get the universities to match it with $1 million, and we hired 42 faculty over a 10-year period into 3 or 4 universities, the research universities, spent $21 million. Within 3 years of those professors arriving at the university, they had garnered more than $350 million worth of federal and other kinds of grant support. And so we call that a 16-to-1 return on our investment. The next thing we did was to help the bright young faculty in the universities get started because the requirement for the eminent scholars were that they be at least in the top 10 and hopefully in the top 5 in the world in that specialty. But there were a lot of bright young people in these universities that are well trained. So we started giving them something called research initiation grants, and the biotechnology center would do peer review. We'd give them about $55,000 for a proof of concept grant. We gave 600 of these grants for $30 million. And within 2 years of us giving that grant, they had gone to the federal government, gotten $360 million back into the universities. We call that a 12-to-1 return. Technology conversion programs are tough for the universities to do, but they're important. It increases commitment of resources. It brings together participants from different cultures. And I don't take time to talk about all that, but these are the things you need to think about. It needs to be affirmed at the top level of the university by action, endorsement, leadership. You need comprehensive supporting things, and critical gaps in financing is important. Now, let's talk about the finances. And y'all tell me when I don't have enough time, but we can stop whenever we need to. It took me 15 years to make this slide, 5 years to think about it, and then over the next 10 years, I kept embellishing it, and I apologize for the complexity, but basically, we matched up the major stages of technology development, and we said, who normally finances those things under normal circumstances? So federal and state people take care of discovery and some of the proof of concept. The federal government has SBIR grants, and industry has some things for technology transfer and development. And then angel investors sometimes get in business, and then the venture capital people come, and then the banks out at the manufacturing and so forth, leasing equipment. There are two major gaps. Gap number one is right here, proof of concept, and gap number two is right here, where you go to the thing. If you have a program that will plug those two gaps, all the rest of it will take care of itself. And so I'm just going to move right on. If you have any questions, write them down. I'll answer when I finish, because I'd love to answer questions better than doing this, but you need to see what I'm talking about. I'm going to talk about how to close both of those gaps at the beginning and at the end. Now, the first gap is what I call the proof of concept gap. There's no money that will move it from the university bench up to where venture capital will invest in it. And so what we did, we set up a convertible loan fund, because you don't have to argue over the value. You simply lend the people the money they need to do proof of concept, prototype development, develop a good business plan. And then the venture people will come and invest in it when it's a solid investment. Up until that time, nobody knows what the value is. So if you make a loan, and then you can convert it at the time the venture people come in. Okay, so let's take a look at that. So the loan is convertible at the first round of VC funding. Why this is so totally important is it gets you to develop your technology locally, but you create deal flow. And if you have plenty of deals to look at, venture capital will come. You don't have to start up a venture capital fund if you have plenty of technology. The venture people will come see you, believe me. North Carolina Biotech Center invested $15 million in 52 startups. The VC follow-on funding was $450 million into those 52 companies. We had 10 IPOs. We sold 10 of them to other companies. We had 14 failures and 18 more. We're trying to figure out whether they're going to be successful or not. But the IPOs and the 10 companies that were sold bought in $550 million. So we made a $15 million investment, and we bought into the state of North Carolina from outside of the state $1 billion. Now, we did the seed fund, and it was a combination kind of seed fund. We took $25 million, $10 million of it came from the state, and that was matched by $15 million from the banks there in North Carolina. We had three large banks there, and they put the money in. We encouraged establishment of seed funds, and the way we did that was we invested in 8 startup seed funds in North Carolina. We put in up to 1% of their closing to help them get. Now, what that did was it made all the investors in the seed fund be able to have a 25% tax credit on their investment. That's really big. Then the North Carolina Biotech Center co-invest in 8 rounds of 10 companies. Okay, at the end of the gap, this is out when a company has gone through all the hoops. They have no product, but they need to manufacture their first product. This happens with a biopharmaceutical company right when they submit their NDA to the federal government. They've got about 18 months to wait for the federal government to make up their mind whether they can go or not go, but they need to be building a manufacturing facility or they need to be contracting it out. I found that it's 50-50. Half the companies want to contract out the manufacturing, the other half would like to build their own manufacturing facility. The banks will not lend them a nickel because they have no cash flow, they have no products. And they think they're risky because banks don't understand the companies. The venture capital people won't put any more money in it. They don't want it to loot out, and they want to exit. So there's no money. So what we did was to, in North Carolina, in the process, we set up a North Carolina Life Science Development Corporation. The state sets aside $100 million debt service reserve. The state doesn't have to put the money. All they have to do is escrow the money. They don't have to give it up. The banks write a letter of credit against the debt service reserve. Bonds are sold at LOC rating. Proceeds are loaned to the young companies, and then the companies pay back like a mortgage over 20 years. And bond sales and business operations are managed by a life science company. I've not been able to get North Carolina to put the debt service reserve in place because we're still arguing about exactly what the mechanism is. But I've been working on this for 3 years. Had we done that on day one 3 years ago, by now we would have built about 10, maybe 12 manufacturing plants in North Carolina. We would have created 15,000 jobs while we are arguing about some little thing about how we're going to do that. But it's really a great need for that right now. There must be 50 or 100 companies that need that kind of service, and there's no money for them. Okay, service and support elements are important, and I'm just going to, you can see that we have all kind of promotional things, Council on Entrepreneurial Development, a bunch of state nonprofits, a biotech center, microelectronics center, technology development park, North Carolina Supercomputing. A properly trained workforce is key to all types and stages of business development. Is the educational requirements per the major stages of development. Early on, most of your people are MS, PhD types. You move to the middle, you get a mixture of MS and so forth. And then at the end, you have where the big payoff is for community college graduates, high school, and BS degree people to work. And that's where the big economic pay is, and that's why it's so important to fill that gap right between the R&D company and the company manufacturing. If you fill that gap, the big payoff comes. What we did in North Carolina, we got coordinated efforts between the community colleges and the universities. We have a BioWorks program. The basic work is done at the community college. The capstone training is done at universities. NCCU University does the technician training for people like biochemists, bacteriologists, clinical pathologists, and then NC State does the hard chemical engineering manufacturing type things to train the bioprocess manufacturing technician. We run about 2,000 people a year through this program. And we need to do about 3,000 people a year to just take care of turnover and have enough people for expansion of the program. It greatly influences recruiting. I can tell you people of all, a number of big companies say they came there because of the BioWorks program. Let's see. Recruiting. We work closely with the Department of Commerce, but I can tell you all the different agencies need to work closely together. But in 15 years, we spent about $5 million recruiting 15 major corporations. They built in North Carolina $9 million worth of facilities and employ 6,000 people. Jim Nichols is here today, and he was so kind to help me do all that back in the good old days. Programs and policies are really important. You need a friendly business environment, innovative, competitive tax structure, cooperative, coordinated state agencies, and that's not always easy. Know your safe, your state region by region. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Workforce training program and incentives. I'm not going to get into incentives. That is really a double-edged sword, but it's almost a fact of life today. Regions. You need to study every region in your country. In North Carolina, we have Western North Carolina, and up there we do timber, herbal plants, and Christmas trees. In the middle, we do technology and some agriculture. In the east, we do agriculture in every way you can think of it, and we do marine science. And so when we take people around to look or to put themselves down somewhere, we find out what it is they want to do, and then we take them to the region that's best at doing that. You need to know the strengths and weaknesses and what the various components are. Now, I'm going to finish up with this, Mark. I'm sorry about taking 5 minutes, but I think we'll do it. Here's why I think life science industry has a great future. As I said, we're only about 20% of the way up the growth curve. It's going to grow at the rate of 8 to 12% a year, depending on whether you're in pharmaceuticals, or agriculture, or industrial. The medical and biopharmaceutical areas are going to continue to dominate and represent probably 50, 55, maybe 60% of the industry. Agriculture is really coming on strong. You know, and this is so wonderful for the rural areas. You know, I'm 72 years old, and this is the first time in my life that I've ever thought we really could do something for the rural areas. But we can do it with biotechnology. And the reason for it is foods, fibers, and biomass. And that includes forestry and things like biofuel. This is going to really revolutionize and change the way your rural areas are going to be. Industrial biotechnology for fuels, enzymes, specialty products for chemical industry. I leaned over to Bob Scunder when he was talking about the announcements you're going to make and said, you guys were really lucky to get Novozymes here in Roanoke. And I tell you, those people are going to grow like crazy. Environmental cleanup, water quality is going to be something of the future. Everybody better know something about water quality in the future. GMOs, genetically modified organisms overlap everywhere in the industry. Thank you very much. I'll answer any questions. Here's the way the technology loop ought to look and run. You start with the entrepreneur, the professor who has an idea. You do some research on that idea. You do the proof of concept. You do the regulatory stuff. You start selling things. The investors make money. They pay taxes, and they cycle some of it back into the next round. Thank you very much.
Questions, ladies and gentlemen? We have time for a few questions here. Any questions? Jim?
How important was having Glaxo's big research facility there before you got started?
It was really nice from the standpoint of the biotech center because I went across the street and said, I need $2 million to build a building, and they said, fine. That was a good start. H. Robbins had a company down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida named Meyer Laboratories. And one day, I think it was 1976, They came by to see Mr. Robbins. It was a bunch from Glaxo came by to see Mr. Robbins. And they purchased Myers Pharmaceuticals. And they had a guy working for Myers Pharmaceuticals named Joe Ravine. And they bought Myers Pharmaceuticals from H. Robbins. And one day I saw Joe and I said, Joe, well, how are things going at Myers Laboratory? He said, oh, it's great. We moved to Research Triangle Park. So these connections are really important. If you know people, they'll help. Thank you.
Other questions? You talked about going to different parts of the state, and you mentioned the Center for the State of Technology. As an outsider, from where we sit here in Virginia, it seems to us that the Center for the State in Research Triangle has enjoyed the legislature's generosity in terms of creating biotech. How did you make that happen when the other two parts of the state seem to get little benefit?
Well, they gripe every time about that darn Research Triangle Park didn't need the help. They had too much money now. I said, that's not the way the state works. They said, what do you mean it's not the way the state works? I said, the money is collected into the general fund, and then you all redistribute it all over the state. Well, it comes from Research Triangle Park and not as immaterial to you all. So you get the money out of the Research Triangle Park, and you spread it around. It's simple.
How did you get the universities to play well with
Joe? Well, that's a great question. That was my second day on job. I went over to see the president of the University of the He was an icon in North Carolina. You know, I'm just a young country boy showing up there, and I was scared to death. And I went in there, and he refused to meet with me. He made me meet with the chief financial officer and the chief academic officer, and he didn't show up. And I'm trying my best now to remember the chief financial officer's name, because his name was Felix something. Let's just say Felix. I know that's your first name. Well, anyway, they said, we're not going to let you get money out of the legislature to come and hire a bunch of professors and compete with us. And I said, well, who told you I was going to do that? And they said, oh, we know you're going to build a building and have a bunch of wet labs. And I said, no, let me tell you something. I was a research professor at the university for 20 years. I would never be stupid enough to hire a bunch of mediocre people and put them out there in the park. Good research professor want to be part of the university. They want to be part of the faculty. They want to be able to interact with all these other smart people. So I said, what I'm going to do is go to the legislature. I'm going to get $5 million a year from them, and then I'm going to help you all hire 10 of the best professors in the world every year. And you'll have them in your universities, and they'll bring the money into your university. And I'll guarantee you we'll more than 10 times the benefit of money. And then Felix said, well, you know, I used to be the budget person of the Georgia system. Well, that's interesting. Felix, I said, you must know Joe Boone. He said, hell yes, I know old Joe. I said, well, old Joe is my father-in-law. And he said, boy, I'll help you. That's fine. Joe, that's my okay, thanks all for right. That question.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Virginia Bioscience Podcast. For more information, please visit us on the web at www.vabio.org.